Welcome to the Heights Church Podcast, a collection of our weekly sermons at Heights Church in Houston, Texas. We hope this message from Dr. Paul Sloan is an encouragement to you as you seek to deepen your faith. For more information about our church, please visit our website at heightschurchhouston.org. If you're in the Houston area, we welcome you to join us for Sunday worship.
Good morning. The gospel lesson comes from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 7, starting in verse 13. 7:13. Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction. There are many who take it, for the gate's narrow and the road's hard that leads to life. There are few who find it. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You'll know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns or figs from thistles? In the same way, every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that doesn't bear good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you'll know them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do the will of my Father in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then I'll declare to them, I never knew you. Go away from me, you who behave lawlessly. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat that house, but it didn't fall because it was built on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and doesn't act on them is like the foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. Now when Jesus had finished saying these words, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, not like their scribes. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
We're almost there. Last section of the Sermon on the Mount, it's Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and this is the last section of Matthew 7. This is sermon number 10, if I read that right. Part 10 of the series on the Sermon on the Mount, in which what I'm trying to do is to make plain the basic elements of Jesus' teachings, because our life as Christians is one in which we're called to discipleship to Christ. And basic to discipleship is living according to the will of God as described and taught by Christ. And so the narrative setting within which the Sermon on the Mount takes place, within the story of Scripture, is, as we've kind of prefaced every week with this, just to kind of drill it in, right, that Israel received the law at the hand of Moses as they're about to enter the land, and they're told, you know, live by this law or else you'll go into exile. And then, of course, Israel violates the law, and so they are sent into exile. But once they're sent into exile and submitted to the punitive discipline of exile and captivity, they're then told, but if you return to me and turn back to God and turn away from your lawlessness and turn back toward me and my own will, then I will return you. I'll restore you to the land, and I'll restore your hearts as well. I won't just change your address from Babylon back to the land. I'll transform your very heart. In Deuteronomy 30, it says I'll circumcise your heart. Another text says I'll purify your heart. Another text says I'll give you a heart transplant. I'll take your stony heart out and put a soft one in. And in Jeremiah's passage that we read just a moment ago, Jeremiah said that God would write his law on the heart. The point is that God in the restoration will change our very will and capacity to be actually submissive to him and to be obedient to him and to walk in the ways that he calls us to. And so that's where the Sermon on the Mount takes place within that context, that it's Jesus presented as the authoritative interpreter of what it means to do God's will. And then after his death and resurrection, he gives his very spirit, and it's that spirit that, according to Acts, purifies your heart, or as Paul says it in Romans 2, circumcises your heart. Or, as he says in 2 Corinthians 3, takes your stony heart out and puts the fleshy heart in. In other words, the heart transformation that God promises, by which the people are able to walk according to God's norms, occurs through the inhabitation of the Spirit given to us. And so then what still remains is to walk according to God's will, which is what Jesus is trying to make plain here. But this is sort of the final volley, though, right? So in Matthew 5 and 6 and a little bit of 7, he's given his interpretation of the will of God, to love your neighbor as yourself, to speak with truthfulness, to have interior purity that expresses itself in pure actions, not to lust after others, not to lust after more money, but to be a generous person who lives with fidelity to the people around you. And so having instructed his audience, he gives them this final volley of exhortations and warnings to enter by the narrow gate. The warning is that the path that they're on, if it's not the path that Christ calls them to, the path that they're on is leading them to destruction. And that's the part I want to pick up here, because there's a lot within this passage. Don't get me wrong. I know. I've read this passage as many times as you have. And every time I'm like, ooh, gosh. You know, like there's just, like when Jesus says, right, you know, people come to me and say, Lord, Lord, didn't I do X, Y, Z in your name? And Jesus says, get away from me, I never knew you. Right? That's a terrifying prospect. So I'm going to do a few things in this sermon. I'm going to talk about what it means that sort of he can describe some paths as leading to destruction. I'm going to talk about what it means for Christ to call people to himself as the one who gives rest. And then to talk about what it means to really specify who he's talking about there. Because if you're the kind of person who's worried about being that kind of person, then you're probably not that kind of person, okay? In other words, if you're the kind of person who's worried, like, oh no, is that going to be me? Am I going to be the one that Jesus says, get away from me, I never knew you? The fact that you already have that concern probably indicates that you're not going to be that kind of person, okay? But we'll unpack what this means, okay? So having instructed his audience, he gives those final volleys and warnings. What I want to make plain, right, is that he's saying it negatively, right? There are some of you that are on a path that it's leading to destruction, but he can also say it positively. He says it positively in Matthew 11, where he says, come to me, I'm the one who gives you rest. Come to me, all who are weary, and take my yoke upon you. It's light and easy. In this, he's actually using the language of Isaiah 55, where he says, come to me, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. You who have no money, come and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money, without cost. Why do you spend money on stuff that's not even bread? Why do you spend your wages on stuff that doesn't satisfy? Listen carefully to me. In Isaiah 55, it's God talking. Listen carefully to me. Eat what is good. Delight yourselves in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live. Or in Jesus' idiom, come to me, all you who are weary, and I'll give you rest. So he can say it negatively, as he does in Matthew 7. There's some of you who are on a path that goes toward destruction. And he can say it positively, come to me, and that leads you away from destruction, right? And so often, I mean, there's an aspect of this that he's warning that there's a future possibility of condemnation. But also, I want to not miss the organic nature of his description here. He's saying that there are certain manners of life that simply lead to destruction because of who God created you to be. If God created you to be the kind of person who's generous and faithful and loving to others and loving even of those who are hostile to you, then if you are the opposite of those things, if you're a person who simply spends his or her life coveting after other people's possessions and never forgiving anybody else and not being generous, the very life that you live will just by definition, because of who God created you to be, it will be the kind of life that is burdened and eventually withers. It can't withstand its own weight. You can't live a life that's constantly chasing the next thing that you're coveting. That itself is the burden. And so when he's saying, like, there are people who are on their way to destruction, part of it, he's simply describing that, like, there's a manner of life that just leads that way because of who God created you to be. This reminds me, actually, I mean, I had a, to kind of picture this, that there's the sort of, you know, using, that there's a manner of life that just leads to destruction. And that the reason for that is because, you know, if you're created to be a certain way, then doing other things, right, that takes you away from that path, it will just simply lead away from the path that God has called you, lead away from the good that God has called you to. To use kind of a silly example, I went to dinner with a guy. This was, gosh, this might have been 10 years ago now. He's kind of a snooty, foodie kind of guy, you know? And so we went to, I mean, I really like sushi, so that's not snooty, foodie. So, but I'm just saying, we went to a sushi spot, and he was kind of a snooty, foodie guy. And so we were there eating the sushi, and, you know, part of it's like, I don't really know how to order, because, like, I've been a couple times, and I like it, but I don't really know how to order, so I'm just kind of, like, let him do his thing, you know, and he'll just order for us. And then also, you know, I want to, like, you know, I'm not trying to, like, be someone I'm not, but I'm also like, I like sushi. I can enjoy all this, right? And so they put food in front of me, and I really like salmon. Even like, you know, when it's uncooked, that's fine with me. Like the thin, like, you know, slices of uncooked salmon. That's fine. That's tasty to me. And so they set this down. It's got a lot of stuff on the plate. Thin slices of this sort of pink orange, you know. So I grab it, and I just pop it in my mouth, and as I get it, and I'm getting it close, my buddy's like, I wouldn't do that, and I was like, you know, I'm sort of acting like offended, like, hey, come on, man, what are you talking about? I do this all the time. And I didn't listen to him. He said, I wouldn't do that, and I was like, okay, bud. And so I popped it in there, and about 2.5 seconds later, my sinuses start to open, and it's getting a little hot in the room, and I had just put a bunch of ginger in my mouth, raw ginger that was next to the wasabi. It was next to the wasabi, and he goes, you thought that was salmon, didn't you? I was like, yeah. He goes, it's ginger, though. I was like, I know now. I know that it's ginger now. And if you guys would know how bad, like, my own spice allergy is, you would know how rough this was. So I'll tell you a different story that's now unrelated to that. It's just sort of the index to you how bad my spice allergy is. So you can talk about Tabasco sauce, and I can sort of, like, feel the sweat break out on my scalp. You know what I mean? Like, it's a problem because I like it, right? Like, I still enjoy it. I still want to use it, but, like, I have to, like, just use it very sparingly, you know? And so once I, the problem is that I always make this particular dish. It's like the jalapeno poppers, right? So the bacon wrapped jalapenos with cream cheese in them, right? Those are delicious. But, like, it's basically lethal for me to make them personally, because what I end up doing is I sort of core the jalapeno out, and I end up getting seeds under my fingernails, and then somehow, inevitably, even though I know every single time I'm supposed to go wash my hands and do everything, I still somehow manage, right, to, like, put my finger in my eyes and nose, and somehow, like, my whole face just, like, you know, just is, it's really bad. But in case you're like, okay, that's happened to me before, it's spicy, I don't think you've had this happen to you like it's happened to me. Once I was at a party with my now wife. At the time, we weren't married, so this was super awkward. We were engaged, and I was with all her friends. We were over at a house, and I had made this dish. And I was like, guys, let me make this dish for you. I think I might have gotten a jalapeno seed, like, up my nose. It was so bad. Like, I was literally, like, all of a sudden, I'm starting to feel hot. I'm like, man, is anyone else hot in here? And, like, nope, just you, bud. I look down. I am actually sweating, like a V on, it looks like I've been playing basketball. I go to the mirror, my face is red. My face is like Valentine's Day red. It's so bad that I'm like profusely sweating. And so then I realize, like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And I tell Meg, and I'm like, hey, Meg, I think I might be having a, she's like, a reaction? Yeah, I know, everyone can tell. And I was like, I don't know really what to do. I'm like, I've washed my hands a bunch. And she goes, well, I do know that actually, like, dairy helps. And so I look up what you're supposed to do. And so I then snuck up to the bathroom upstairs with a bowl of yogurt and just put yogurt on my face. And I looked like Mrs. Doubtfire when she puts her face in the cake. And I just had to hide up in this bathroom with yogurt on my face to try to, like, get the jalapeno oil off of my face. It was pretty rough. And then I had to, like, eventually, like, effectively, like, wash it all off just to, like, be presentable to go back down to the party and be like, yeah, guys, I'm fine. But I still looked red and sweaty. This was like a 5-minute story away from the point about Jesus. The point is that, like, he knows that, like, buddy, you're about to eat the ginger. Don't eat the ginger. You think it's salmon? It's not salmon. Don't go there, Al. Trust me. I know what I'm talking about. I mean, it's actually what my mom tries to do every, or my wife as well. Every time I try to make the jalapeno poppers, they're like, please just don't. Like, please just let me make them. Why do you, okay, you can eat them, but like, please just let someone else make them. Why do you insist on it every time, right? This is the logic of his instruction here. He's like, please listen to me. I know what I'm talking about. The way that you're going is going to end up with you having a reaction in the bathroom where you have to put yogurt on your face. It's going to destroy you. Like, don't do this. So again, positively, what he's saying is, come to me. I'm the one who's not even just like selling the best water. I'm giving away the water that leads to life, and I'm giving it away without cost. Why would you go somewhere else? Come to me, all you are weary and tired. I'll give you rest. Or again, in Isaiah 55, like, come to me and I'll give you water. Why are you wasting your money on stuff that isn't even water? Why are you wasting your money on stuff that isn't even bread? It's not even going to satisfy you. Again, once you inflected this, once you apply this to his own instruction, he's saying, don't waste your life doing the kind of stuff that will actually burden you. We often think, I mean, I've said this before, you often think that Jesus' instructions are the ones that are like a burdened life. You're like, man, this is a lot of rules. This is really hard. We're like, don't lust, be generous, don't lust, like, turn the other cheek, forgive enemies. Like, man, that's a really burdensome life. It's really hard to live that way. It's the opposite. Living a life with those things is the burden. A life in which you're always coveting the next thing and you're never satisfied with what you have. You're never content with what you have. You're only ever planning to be content, so it's inevitable that you never will be. That's the burden life. A life in which you're always just wanting the next thing and the thing you're at never can satisfy you because you have a heart that just always wants more. That's a burdened life. You can never be content in your relationships, never can be content in your job, never can be content with what you have. Always pursuing the next thing, that's the life burden. And so Jesus is saying, come to me and take my yoke on you. In other words, take my burden on you, and my burden's actually light compared to the stuff you're destroying yourself with. He goes on, he says, beware the false prophets. And this is where I'll clarify what he means here, right? Because this is the passage in which he says, there will be some who come to me in that day and say, Lord, Lord, and he'll say, you know, get away from me. So he says, beware of the false prophets. So already, that's who he's talking about. So that's the main thing right here. He's not talking about a person who believes Christ and is trying to live his or her life sort of in his walking, and that someday you might show up and Christ say, nope, don't know you. That's not what he's talking about. Here he's talking to what we'd call insiders, and he's saying, beware of false prophets who are dressed like sheep but act like wolves. You'll know them by their fruits. Grapes aren't gathered from thorn brushes, or figs from thistles, are they? No, rather, good tree bears good fruit, etc. If you were to give this example today, he might be like, don't be like these guys who are Christmas trees who look really shiny on the outside. But what is every Christmas tree that's in your house? What's true of it? It's dead. One of the shiniest, most beautiful trees you've ever seen, right? Except it's dead. So he says, there are people come to me and say, like, Lord, didn't I prophesy in your name? Didn't I expel demons in your name? And he says, get away from me, you who work lawlessness. In other words, again, this is a message to the insiders, right? So now speaking to people who claim to know Christ but then deny him with everything else, right? He gives this warning. Don't just say to me, look at all these works of power I've done. So again, note, he's not saying that sort of acts of obedience might not serve as good evidence. In other words, like, I think he is saying that, yeah, obedience to Christ can serve as good evidence that you belong to Christ, right? So he's not saying that obedience can't act as evidence toward belonging to Christ. He's talking about what kind of evidence actually serves as evidence. And simply doing powerful works in Christ's name is not that kind of evidence. So he's not critiquing a person for having obeyed. He's critiquing a person who thinks that certain kind of behaviors indicate fidelity. Doing miracles, healing, exercising in Jesus' name don't indicate that that person's actually followed Christ. It might just be that they've used his name like a powerful talisman, but they don't care about Christ himself. They only care about what Christ gets them. And so I'm not saying, or sorry, I want to be clear about what Christ is saying. When he's talking to, say, you or you or you, and you come before him and you say, Christ, I know you, I love you, and I've, of course, walked imperfectly, but I've tried to walk behind you. The scripture's testimony is, he says, well done, good and faithful servant. But to the person who shows him and said, Christ, I taught Bible study every day in your name. And I preached sermons in your name every Sunday. I taught at a Christian university. And but I denied you with everything else, but I taught Bible study in your name, you know. And every other aspect of my life was one of lawlessness, but I taught Bible study in your name. It's to this person who says, like, hey, you've potentially led people astray because you acted like a sheep. You looked like a sheep, but you acted like a wolf. And these are just sort of easy examples, right? I mean, you talk about people who are like, you know, the sort of example of sort of like a, not all televangelists are bad, that's not my point, but like televangelists who like prey on people. I mean, there's a lot of predatory behavior and a lot of televangelist behavior, right? Who get people to send in money for promise that they'll pray for them or something, and then that's all they ever do. I think this is the sort of thing he's talking about. This is a false prophet who like is simply using people and preying on people. And to that person, Christ says, look, you didn't know me. He then says that everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them may be compared to a wise man, etc. Again, what these words are doing is he's inviting his people, inviting those who are following them to live the life that God has called them to live the fullest possible human life. This is the way that Paul talks about Christ, that he is the very image of God. And it's distinct from what Genesis says, right? Genesis says that humans were created in the image of God. In other words, that there's an image that exists, and humans were created in that image. Paul doesn't say that Christ is like the image of God or in the image of God. Paul says Christ is the image of God. In other words, for Paul, Christ functioned as the image according to which humans were patterned. In other words, the pattern or the prototype into which humans are to mature and develop and be transformed into is Christ himself. In other words, the fullest human is Christ himself. And so Christ's instructions are calling his people to live their fullest human life, one that imitates him. Obviously, he assumes, please don't ever hear me wrong, he assumes this will be done imperfectly by his people. He's not requiring sinless perfection in order to enter into the kingdom of heaven. You know that because the whole sermon is emphasized the need to forgive each other, the need to be merciful. And the need to cry out to God for forgiveness. And so he assumes that divine and human forgiveness are an aspect of the covenantal relationship. So he's not trying to teach that sort of like sinless perfection is required. What he's trying to teach is like, hey, following me leads to the fullest kind of human that God created you to be. A kind of human that is generous, doesn't just lust after others for what they can get you, and loves others truly from the heart, lives with purity of heart and intention, and loves their enemies. Not because the enemies aren't really enemies, but because you're imitating the God who himself reigns and sends sunshine on both the good and the evil. And so with this closing lesson, what he says is he says, come to me and I'll give you the water that leads to life. Follow me because the way I walk is the way that God has created humans to walk. Follow me and you will walk in the way that both leads to life and away from destruction, but also you'll become the kind of human that God created you to be, a kind of human that lives without burdens that we place upon ourselves and instead lives with a life patterned after Christ himself because he's the model of true humanhood. And he closes this teaching. The text says the result was that when Jesus finished these words, the multitudes were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority. Not as their scribes. In other words, he reads the law and the prophets and the gospels, present him as the one both authorized by his Father to provide this authoritative interpretation of God's will for his people so that the people can walk in it. So I'll close again with this reading from Isaiah 55. It's the invitation of God and Isaiah to his people, and it's the invitation of Jesus to us. Listen, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. You who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine, buy milk. Buy it without money and without cost. Why do you spend money for what's not bread? Why do you spend your wages for what doesn't satisfy? Listen carefully to me. Eat what's good. Delight yourself with this abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen, that you may live.
Thanks for listening to the Heights Church Podcast, a collection of sermons delivered at Heights Church, founded in 1908 in Houston, Texas. We hope this message was edifying and encouraging.